Welcome back to the Namaste podcast. This is Jen.
Hey, everybody. And this is Tisha.
And we are super excited for today's episode. We've got some really great content and a really awesome guest. So I'm going to pass the mic over to Tisha to introduce today's guest.
Yes, we're super excited about today's guest. Namaste. Y'all are in for a huge treat. And just sit back and enjoy this episode. Today's guest, we have Spencer George with us. Spencer is a writer and teaching artist based in North Carolina. She holds a BA in English and Human Rights with a concentration in creative writing from Barnard College and is an incoming MA student in folklore at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her work focuses on the intersection of storytelling, folklore, and empathy in the rural South. With a particular focus on the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina, her family hails from, and the many stories of strange happenings they bring with them. Her writing has been published in The Bitter Southerner, The Adroit Journal, and Medium, and once received a shout out in the New York Times. She is the creator and writer of Good Folk, a weekly newsletter about the people and stories of rural America and the American South. Currently, she serves as an Artist Year Senior Fellow in Creative Writing and the Special Initiatives Assistant at Girls Write Now. Spencer is the 2019 recipient of the Peter S. Prescott Prize for Prose Writing and is at work on a reimagined Southern Gothic novel about young queer love and the radical power of hope. If that is not enough to blow your freaking minds, we are in for a treat, guys. I cannot wait for Spencer to share with us and just tell us all the things that are happening in her life and how she navigates the world as an artist and a writer and folklorist and everything. So let's just jump right in. Jen's going to start off our show with our first question.
All right. Well, welcome, Spencer. And as Tisha said, that is quite the bio. So I'm really excited to hear more about you. One of the things that jumped out to me was your experience with intersectionality in your writing, in your experience, in your exploration. So I'm wondering, like, why is intersectionality so important in your work as an author? And why do you think our educators and our audience here at Namasteach should be intentional about exposing their students to various intersections, cross-sections, different voices, different representations, such as those that you write about and beyond? So what do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Tisha. Hi, Jen. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me. I think to answer that, it's important to give a little bit of background into kind of the work that I do and how I got started with it. So I grew up in North and South Carolina, went to high school in Charleston, never identified as a Southerner. My whole family is from kind of Appalachian, North Carolina area, but I could not wait personally to get out of the South. I had no interest in it. I thought if I wanted to have a creative career, there was no possibility to do that there. So I went to New York City, which is kind of the major hub of modern publishing, modern literature, modern writing, and storytelling. And I moved to New York in 2016. And what I found is I very quickly became a representative of the South, whether it was by choice or by not. I was getting thrown by a lot of peers in these spaces in New York City. I was one of maybe two or three Southerners that I knew of within my school environment. And people had a lot of questions and they had a lot of thoughts. And the number one thing I found is they had a lot of stereotypes. Even if I had never loved the South, I could still find things growing up there that I could appreciate. And especially when that comes to rural areas, people had a very one-sided, very stereotypical view of what it meant to be a Southerner, and especially what it looked like to be a Southerner. And I definitely resisted becoming this person for a few years, at least, of I don't want to talk about the South. I don't want to do this. But I just kept finding myself get more and more angry at the ways in which people would casually stereotype and say things that I knew were not true. And most of the time, this came from people who had either never been South, had never met anyone from the South, and was getting all of that information from Twitter, from social media, from television, from books they're reading. Which extends into a larger problem in that storytelling is not often representative of a variety of communities, and especially when it comes to rural and Southern storytelling. So over the course of those few years, I got into this work by I took a memoir class with an amazing professor named Jenny Boylan. She is a transgender writer, advocate. She's been on Oprah. She's incredible. And that class definitely changed my life because it forced me to think of storytelling as something that was not just about me and what I could bring to the world, but almost as a part of a community and working in conversation with all these other voices. And I started writing about the South. What everyone kept telling me is, you're writing the new version of Hillbilly Elegy. I see now in retrospect, that's almost an insult, even if it's a it's a well-intentioned insult. But Hillbilly Elegy is not representative of the South, nor of the voices. So I started going down that path, and then I ended up having an amazing opportunity to study abroad. And I lived in Chile, Nepal, and Jordan for a little while I was in college. And I had a conversation while I was in Jordan with a man who works for UNESCO. He's a teacher. And I was on this program, I was doing thesis research, talking to people about intersectional storytelling around the world, the role of testimony in human rights advocacy. And the conversation kept coming back to Appalachian, North Carolina, and this place that's always felt most like home for me. And he said, well, I wanna hear more about your home. Can you tell me more about that? And I remember I just started going on and on and on. And I knew in that moment that I had to come back and do this kind of work because the stereotypes that people both within the South, within America, within New York City, and all around the world have of this place and what it means to be a rural Southerner is so far from the truth. And what I found, I've been back here now for 2 years working as a teaching artist with an organization called Artist Year. And the work I get to do for them, I have partnered with two middle schools, both pretty rural, one definitely much further out, out in Moore County, up in the north part in a little town called Robbins. And then one now I work in Sanford in Lee County, which is about 45 minutes south of Raleigh, but still decently rural. Neither of those schools would look like people's perception. And one thing that I found is so important is even within the South and within this community, we still place these hierarchies on things. I would have other teachers who I worked with refer to students whose families might have come from like the Appalachian Mountains. And they would say these things of, oh, you know, we're all rural, but we're like the good kind of rural. And they're like the uncivilized kind of rural. And even within that, there's these elements and nuances that people have to have these stereotypes. And that's how we've always survived in the world. But I think that storytelling can be a practice to break those down and to increase this intersectionality. A lot of things that people don't know about or don't talk about is more than 60% of LGBT Americans in this whole country live in the South, Midwest, and Mountain states combined. And the highest percentage of LGBT individuals is actually in the Southeast at 35%. The Northeast, in contrast, only has 19%. That's something that I had no idea about until I started looking into it myself, because we don't get that representation. We don't have those stories. And especially growing up as like a young queer person in the South, I didn't even think that life would be possible for me until you start increasing storytelling and increasing the intersectionality within storytelling. We're gonna continue to have this narrative that, oh yeah, if you wanna have a life with meaning, if you wanna have a creative career, you have to get out. You're not gonna be able to be happy here because we've never given representation of what that looks like. So I write at a lot of those intersections of identity, but also not just with my voice. So much of what I have thought about in the work that I do, I spend some time working with StoryCorps, which is an amazing organization that gathers people's stories around the country, is that we have to have everything in community. It does not matter if my voice is just going out there and saying these things, if there aren't other people's voices that are also being uplifted within that. That's the role I hope to play with Good Folk and my newsletter. We do publish stories from rural Southern individuals. You can write in, send us anything, we will share it. We're going to be transitioning into leading virtual writing workshops with the goal that as things settle down with COVID, we will have in-person rural writing workshops to the work essentially in all of this with storytelling and stereotyping is the more voices we can increase and share and use the resources that we have to share, the better we will all be. And there are some amazing organizations in the South doing this work. This is not obviously just me, but that's kind of the role that I hope to play through the intersectionality pieces. Speaking my truth and what I know, but also doing the best I can to uplift the amazing diverse community of individuals around me, because I teach an incredible group of students, very few of whom look like me. And I do experience the privilege in the world of I'm a blonde white person. Most people are gonna stereotype the South with someone who looks like me. That's not true. And I just like to hope that I could help move away from that perception through the work of increasing storytelling opportunities. Awesome. And that's a very long-winded answer on that.
No, it's wonderful. I mean, gosh, you took us so many places with everything you said. And I'm just thinking about, you know, you as a teacher, I mean, you taught us just in what your answer was, so many different ways of looking at the South and the role of story and intersectionality. I'm learning about that now a lot in my PhD program. We talk about that all the time and the ways identities intersect, and there's not a monolith in human beings. And we see that, and those voices coming out and forward is so vital to our humanity and what we see in each other. But this next question is kind of a multi-part, and it's going back to your teaching. Who inspired you, or what inspired you to teach? Did you always see yourself as a teacher? Did you always want to be a teacher? Like when you're growing up, that was like, was there a teacher that just inspired you? It's like, I want to do that in your work that you do in the world with students and as an artist. Also, what is your superpower? And can you tell us more about the organization Girls Write Now and what you lead that work? How do you go forth with that work in Girls Write?
Yeah, absolutely. They're all very connected. So this will work out nicely. I did not ever want to be a teacher. I fell into it completely through accident. And one thing that is interesting, the role that I do as a teaching artist is I actually am not employed by the school system. So I'm employed by a nonprofit that then pairs me with schools. So I've worked largely in middle schools through this job. And I have a lot of independence over curriculum design and leading clubs, but I'm not actually necessarily responsible for an entire classroom of kids. So I work with a lot of different teachers to come in and do arts integration lessons, which is much preferable to being a teacher. I think the American education system is definitely at a turning point right now, definitely a moment of crisis. And we're witnessing so much change within that. So it's been a really interesting time to be in schools. But growing up, I wanted to be a writer my whole life. Before that, I think I wanted to be like a pop star. But I remember I was 6 years old and I read Harry Potter for the first time and I closed the last book and I was staying at my grandparents' house and they live in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I immediately walked out and we had desktop computers. There were no laptops back then. And I sat down at the desktop computer and I said, whatever that book just did to me, I want to do that to other people. And I sat down, I started writing my first book that day. And I think I was like 6 or 7 years old and have never looked back. So I've written quite a few novels over the years. I've done a lot of journalism work, published a lot of things, went and got a degree in creative writing. Writing is hard. As everyone always says, it is not the easiest career path, but that is always going to be kind of my first and foremost. What I've found over the years is I did not like writing solely as my day job. I've always written around school and around teaching and around deadlines and work. So I function best when I can write as like a relief from all of that, rather than a thing that is my sole day-to-day job. It starts to become very stressful for me at that point. So I fell into teaching because I was looking for opportunities to do this kind of work in the South. I graduated in 2020, so right at the start of the pandemic, and I had a couple plans to do some freelance documentary work. I was gonna be filming with a friend in Ohio, looking at a diner out there, and then I was gonna travel for a little while, and both of those plans very quickly fell apart. It just happened that I was back in Charleston. I was visiting my mom, where I got stranded because of COVID, and I found an organization that I had known about for a long time, Artist Year, which is currently where I work, happened to be expanding to rural North Carolina that year. I'd struggled for a long time to figure out, I know I want to work in the rural South. I know that's where I want to be. That's what feels important, but struggling to find opportunities to do that work. So it all fell into place very quickly. I applied for the job, ended up getting it, launched the whole program in a brand new set of schools last year, and then again in a brand new county this year, and fell into kind of teaching through that. But I actually had been doing it unintentionally for a long time through my work with Girls Write Now, which is an amazing organization based in New York City. I've been there, gosh, like 6 or 7 years now in a variety of capacities. But they are a literary nonprofit that pairs teen girls and gender nonconforming youth with professional mentors in the creative space. So oftentimes writers and editors, but sometimes filmmakers, sometimes people who might work at like Forbes, but maybe in a creative department, people who work in publishing, graphic designers. anyone who can serve as a creative mentor. Within that, we host workshops once a month. We host salons usually every week. We are working to kind of create this whole writing community. And then the role that I've always played largely within that is something called our anthology production, which we have these workshops once a month with teaching artists, which is now what I do full time. So it kind of played right into that, working with New York City high schoolers to doing it now with North Carolina middle schoolers. But the job that I've always done with the high schoolers is at the end of each year, through all these workshops they've done, they would choose one piece they've written, and we put it into an anthology. So I work with someone named Molly McDermott. She's been at Girls Right Now a long time. I've been working with her a very long time. And the two of us largely spearhead something called our anthology. This year, it's going to be called Taking Root. I actually just sent the first pass final edits back over to the publisher this morning. So that'll be coming out in May. And I think that's the sixth anthology I've done with them. We do one every year. And then we did one for our 20th anniversary. And we're going to be doing one for the 25th anniversary. That's generally published by Penguin Random House. And this year it is 600 pages of writing from New York City high schoolers, gender nonconforming youth. With the pandemic, we actually expanded virtually. So now we have mentees like all across the country, still largely based in New York, but it is pretty cool to see that program take shape. So a lot of the work I've been doing with them has been involved in teaching without even really knowing it. So it's set up very nicely. And I love working with kids. I think it's funny, a lot of people in my life, I was like, I don't know if I want children myself, but I love working with children. I just don't know if I want to come home to them. And middle schoolers are a very special age. I think it takes the right kind of person, but I love them. And I will not be staying in education. I'm going back to get my master's degree, but I hope to be involved with teaching kids for a very long time. I had some amazing writing teachers that really told me, I had a couple teachers who would often say, you know, whether you want to go back and write about the South or not, that is what you need to be doing. And I don't think I would have ever gotten where I am now without that kind of tough love element. And I like to think what I can bring to my students more than anything else is just representation of like, I was in the New York or North Carolina public school system. I know kind of what it's like to be where you are. And there are options and there are so many different things you can do to live a creative life. And I have a lot of young queer students. So I like to think I can be a role model in that capacity for them as well. And I hope I learn from them as much as I hope they learn from me, but they're amazing. I do love teaching for sure.
That's so awesome, Spencer. I feel like I have so many questions and comments and like completely off script at this point, because I also have a special place in my heart for the adolescent population. I agree. It takes a kind of crazy and special type of person to really love that population, but they're just at such an impressionable age. And we can all, I think, remember back to that time in our life where it's so awkward and you're trying to figure things out. And then if there are other elements on top of that, so having good role models and good mentors, I'm just really grateful for the work that you're doing in your sphere of influence. And I can totally identify with you on that 100%. Yeah.
These kids, I find the hardest thing when you think about it, and this is a problem across the board in education right now, of like children, and especially young teenagers, they want to have these big conversations, right? Like they have all of these things that they're experiencing and these ideas that they're having. And the problem right now is that you're seeing a lot of schools try to kind of push back on that creative expression. And I think the American education system really is teaching you how to conform more than anything else. And that's one perk where I'm not directly employed by the school system. Absolutely. So I can push that line a little bit. But I try to show my students, A, there's a massive importance in telling your story. Like your story matters, and you going out in the world and telling this can really change how people see both this region, this place, how you see yourself, how you connect to yourself. And also they're eager to talk about these things that they're experiencing. They're growing up in what is such a crazy time in the world where it's just thing after thing after thing and constant exposure through social media. And if we don't use like creative practices to create a space for that, and we just say, oh, well, you can't talk about that at school. That's not school appropriate. Right. Or, you know, have that conversation at home or have that outside of class. We're leaving them just completely on their own with no resources to process these things. And we're seeing that kind of snowball into just mental health crisis after mental health crisis. And I know storytelling and writing largely by far has saved my life over the years. And I hope that that's something that we can create a space for these conversations rather than just shutting them down. Because kids, whether they're 8 years old or 15 years old, they want to be talking about what they're experiencing.
Absolutely. And I think that you spoke to a point of like, if we don't create those spaces, they may not get them anywhere else. So if you're like, oh, just talk about this at home, well, they might not be in a home environment which is open to that or inclusive of what they identify with or whatever the case may be. So I think that that is something that's an important takeaway for our listeners of like, how are we creating space for what matters, right? We already know the system has a lot of flaws and brokenness and some of the terminology you used, I can't remember, but you hit the nail on the head that it's a difficult time to be in schools, especially for everybody involved. So how can we in our Namaste Teach community create these spaces and bring in people such as yourself in these art integration capacities or in these like indirect ways where you're not necessarily employed by the school system, but you can bring more exposure to the students and help kind of pair up with teachers. I think that's something that I'm very passionate about. So I would love to talk to you more about that later because I also co-run a journalism program for middle schoolers. So we might
Amazing. Yeah, we definitely have a lot of overlap. We'll have to talk.
Absolutely. More. So that will be the post conversation, but we will share all of Spencer's information for anyone that wants a post conversation as well. But I'm going to shift gears a little bit and just kind of ask, and I'm going to weave this into some of our conversation. So we always like to ask our guests, like, what's bringing you joy right now and what book recommendations you have and top three favorites. But I also wonder specifically about like some of the, topics that you're passionate about. For example, I'm trying to read more gender nonconforming novels just to educate myself. I just finished Frankie and Bug by Gail Forman. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's just a fiction work that, it was really good. So anything like, of course, what's bringing you joy and what book recommendations you have, but then also others that could educate us about different voices, rural self and, you know, the gender or the LGBTQ community or gender nonconforming community. If you could just enlighten us a little bit, Spencer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can put together like a whole list of these too to share out because there are so many and I'm sure I'm going to forget some, but in terms of my top three favorite books. I would say my number one favorite book is a book that a lot of people don't know, but it's called Arcadia by Lauren Groff, who is an author a lot of people know. She's amazing. She's from Florida. And that book it's essentially following the story of a child who grows up in a commune in upstate New York and then eventually leaves. But so much of it is really connected to the idea of like finding beauty and joy in the smallest of moments. As someone who struggled a lot with like depression and a variety of mental illness things over the years, learning to find as a creative person as well, we don't get a lot of representation of like what it's like to live a happy and creative life. That's not really something we're taught is possible. So this was a book that I read at a very pivotal moment of my life and realized like you have to pay attention to the small moments in order to survive in the world. And I do really fundamentally believe in that. I was never an optimist until the last like 3 years, but I think hope is a radical and transformative practice. And we should encourage that more through storytelling. Within that, two other books that I absolutely love are The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Incredible book. A lot of people know it. And then an author named Leslie Jameson, who has two books, one called The Empathy Exams, which is an essay collection about empathy. That's really what got me into this work of thinking about empathy as a critical practice, and also empathy as a choice. So a lot of what she talks about in those essays is being an empathetic person is not our innate nature. It's not something that is automatically going to come easy to us. Being an empathetic person is, first off, not about directly understanding anything anyone is going to go through, because we all have such a variety of lived experiences. I'm never fully going to be able to understand what anyone else is experiencing. That doesn't mean I can't choose to care. And that's really what I think this book does a great job of looking at, of like empathy. Really, people misinterpret it of like, I had so many peers in college who were just like, well, we're never going to understand how we all feel. So why even try? And then would just shut down. And I think my argument back to that is, well, we have to try to care, even if we're not going to understand, because if we don't care, and we don't believe there's something better for all of us, then what's the point of any of this, right? And she has another book that she came out with a few years later called The Recovering, which is a memoir style long book of her journey, being a writer, going through grad school, becoming an alcoholic, and then trying to kind of unpack this idea of like, what does it look like to live a happy creative career? And to me, that's very tied to like, what does it look like to live kind of a rural Southern career. There are so many creative people that I interact with here all the time that are doing just absolutely mind-blowing creative work.
you're probably not going to see them in the New York Times. And that is the bigger fundamental problem. But I think that this book allowed me to kind of separate my life from what are the conventions of what it has to look like and where can we go from here. And Ocean Vuong is an amazing queer author, and he's the author of a book called On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, which has been everywhere the last few years. And he has a whole quote about like queerness saving his life because it forced him to think outside the conventions of what is expected and what is possible. And that's something I think about all the time, especially when it comes to, you know, Jen, you were talking about queer literature and gender nonconforming literature and this idea of art that breaks beyond boundaries, and also that kind of forces us to engage those empathetic capacities, because it might be someone talking about an experience that is not our identity or is not something we go through. But I think about that quote all the time of art can save your life, as can forcing yourself to kind of get out the outside of the realm of what is expected and possible for you. A couple other books kind of on that note that I love. Ocean Vuong, he's a poet largely, but anything by him is incredible. I just finished a book like 2 days ago called Outlawed by Anna North, which is so fun, and is like a retelling of an American West set in 1894, but I'm pretty sure it's like future 1894. And it's all about this girl who joins a gang of like queer youth, basically. And they're like robbing all these people in futuristic Colorado. And it's fantastic. Another book kind of within that vein, and probably the most similar to the writing that I'm kind of working on. I'm currently pitching my novel to agents right now, so that's been a fun process, but is a book called Boys of Alabama by an author named Genevieve Hudson. It is about an almost cult-like football team in Alabama and all kinds of magic powers. And it's a German immigrant family who comes over for the car dealership position. So a lot of nuances of like, people don't often think about the fact that there are European immigrants in Alabama, but there absolutely are. And Genevieve Hudson does an amazing job of kind of unpacking that and weaving in magical realism. Not so much Southern or queer, but The Roundhouse by Louise Erdich. She's a Native American author. That book I read for a course in college. I have not stopped thinking about it ever since. And then I'm currently reading Greenwood by Michael Christie, although I'm only about 10 pages into that. So we'll see how that one goes, but I will definitely put together a whole list of a variety of authors working in the modern South. Ashley Bryant Phillips is another amazing one. Nima Avashia also just came out with a book through, I believe it's West Virginia University Press, about growing up queer and Indian in the Appalachian Mountains, which is identities we don't often see represented. So I haven't gotten to read it yet, but I'm super excited about that one. And in terms of what's bringing me joy, yeah, to go back to that initial one, right now, what is bringing me joy is everything starting to bloom and become green again. It's always one of my favorite times of year of sometimes I'm like, I left New York City. I walked out on a lot of great job opportunities. What am I doing with my life here? And then I walk outside and I see everything look beautiful and green. And I remember that this is the place that's always going to be where my roots are more than anywhere else.
Absolutely. Well, I can't wait to get on the Spencer George book list because you just threw some amazing titles at us, and I'm really excited to share this with everybody and start reading. So thank you for those. And I totally agree. You know how Dove chocolates have like a message? I love tea messages and I love Dove chocolate messages. And mine yesterday was like, spring is a time of hope. So I totally agree on that one. All right. I could go on and on, but I will pass the mic over to Tisha.
All right. Yeah. I'm just so enjoying this conversation and just like thinking about everything. And I'm just like looking outside and it is beautiful. And this time of year really does spark a lot of hope and a lot of creativity in with spring. And we can see how just the cycles of life and new birth and everything that comes with it. But let's just go back to a little bit. I want to circle back for a moment to storytelling in the South. I grew up in the Northeast, and my family is from the South, particularly like Berkeley County in South Carolina. But really, I want you to talk about what makes the South different, like the rural South from the urban South to other major cities. I mean, it's a very unique place. And there's so much. It's like, this is like the cradle of the birth of this nation. Like the South has so much to offer, and so many people are finding these hidden gems in the South. You know, so your travels around the world, what keeps you like coming back? You talked about the South a lot, but what's so special about the South?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. I think what's felt important for me, I'm a Cancer, so home is always something that's on the back of my mind all the time. And I think, and my mom was the first person to ever leave North Carolina with our family. So my family, it's a very cool story of kind of migration throughout. We don't really actually know where we were before, but we were in Mount Toast, which is a little town outside of Mount Airy, North Carolina. And then my grandma had my mom at 18 and moved from Toast to Winston-Salem, which at the time was actually a major city. Most people don't know this. The Empire State Building is based on a building in downtown Winston-Salem. That fact always blows people's minds when I say that, but it was at one point the hub of the tobacco industry. So we're seeing all these shifts. I mean, the South had everything. And now that's kind of moved away, which is a whole nother conversation. But my mom went to Winston-Salem. That's where she grew up. And then she ended up going to Chapel Hill, and she was the first person to go to college before going to New York City. And then kind of the trajectory of our family has been very strange because I grew up very disconnected from a lot of my North Carolina family, where for my mom, I think in order to kind of leave a lot of things behind and experience the kind of life she did, it just wasn't always possible to stay super connected. So as an adult, a lot of what's been strange for me is feeling like, what is my home and what is my place? Because I actually was not born in the South by a total accident. I happened to be born in San Francisco, which was where my parents were living at the time. But then I grew up my whole life. I lived in San Francisco for like a year and then grew up the whole rest of the time in North and South Carolina, which is where the whole rest of our family is. And I think it's always felt very complicated of like, what is the kind of place I can call home? Like, do I even have the ability to lay claim to this? And I try to be very frank of when I talk about Appalachian studies, a lot of people will place on me like, oh, you're an Appalachian writer because that's where your family's from. And I'm like, well, that's not actually my identity. I cannot claim that because I didn't grow up that way. And I feel like I've always grown up with one foot in a very urban world and one foot in much more of a Southern world. And now one foot both in like the history of my family, which comes from a very rural area, and then my experience now the last few years being in a rural area. And the South is very distinct and very different. A thing that drives me crazy that people will talk about is the South is a monolith. The South, like anything south of Virginia, whether it's urban, whether it's rural, you know, it's all the same. And we don't talk a lot about, if you look at the breakdown, I mean, North Carolina was almost a swing state in the last election. It probably will be in the next one. You have these large, very like liberal left cities surrounded by a lot of more kind of small red towns. That is something that is, they're very different. I lived last year in a tiny little military town in an area called the Sand Hills of North Carolina. And now I live right on the border of Chapel Hill and Durham. Two very different experiences. We cannot talk about the South as a monolith when we're looking to the future, right? We have to understand there's a difference in all of these places. Exactly like you said, there's the urban South, there's these major American cities that are just as big as cities anywhere else. And then there are these more kind of rural areas. And all of those need to be looked at and treated differently because they're different kinds of places. One thing I've noticed, and I think I touched on this a little bit earlier, is there's the idea of like a good rural area and the idea of like a bad rural area. And I think often of like, when I was growing up, I would just tell everyone I was from California because it was so much easier. And if I just say, even if whether you're from urban or rural California, if you go out in the world and you just say, oh, I'm from California, people say, oh yeah, that's cool. Like the South is one of those places where you can never just be like Southern, right? There's always all these different identities and things attached to it. And whenever I tell someone like, oh yeah, I grew up in North Carolina, or, oh, I left New York to move back to North Carolina, there's always follow-up questions. There's no just like, oh, that's cool. If I were to say, oh, I moved to like rural Colorado, I don't believe that people would have the same kind of experience because everyone is like, well, why North Carolina? Like, why would you want to go back there? There's a good rural area and there's a bad rural area. Despite the fact that, you know, if you think of, I would think of like a good rural area would be something we'd look at like Colorado, Wyoming, Oregon, these areas that we generally view as more liberal or leftist. That's leaving out an entire population of people in the South who've chosen either to move here, to stay, or to come back because they do believe that there's things of value. There's something special and unique about this place. Joan Didion in one of her best essays of all time called Goodbye to All That, which is her love letter to leaving New York. It became the quintessential I'm leaving New York essay. But she has a whole paragraph in that piece where she talks about Southerners seeming to be in New York on a temporary basis only, that they were always looking for the next flight or the next train home. And that's always how Southerners are going to exist in the world, because there is nowhere else that's going to feel like home the way that this does. And that's something as a writer, I struggle to put into words because I don't know how to explain that feeling. I just know that whenever I am away, this is the only place I ever want to be, or the only place I can ever really imagine feeling like home. And yeah, I think often of like, things would be so much easier if I didn't have to be a Southerner, right? If you're from any other place in America, you can just kind of be an American. But being an American in a modern day South and choosing to be here is a different conversation.
It is very unique. And I'm just thinking about the different ethnic voices that are in the South now and people that are coming back from all over the place and internationally, even, you know, adding to that landscape of the South. It's really pretty remarkable. And just, you know, how Charleston is an international city and there's people here, but it's still the South.
And oh, yeah.
Cosmopolitan bent on Charleston as being like very, you know, hip and progressive, but then you still got that Southern history there. So the South is like the best part of America, I think.
The South has the most culture by far. Yes. And even within rural towns, like one thing that, it's like shameful to even say this is surprising, but rural towns, the ones I've been in, have been such a cultural mixing pot. People were always very surprised when I would tell them like, oh yeah, the school I teach in is like 90% Spanish speaking students. Like most of the teachers there, we would learn both languages. Most of my students are bilingual. A lot of them, their parents came over or they came over, and people were always very surprised. They're like, in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And that's the problem when we stereotype an area, we assume that only one group of people can live there. And right now the South is getting flack for it's one group of people and they're all a bunch of like red Republicans who are terrible people. And that's just not always true. And the other thing we don't talk about when we talk about the South and this myth of like, you have to leave to make something of yourself is we're leaving out an entire group of people who A, don't have the means possibly to leave, and B, don't want to have to leave behind their home and their family and everything they are, right? In the book I'm pitching right now, this has been a huge plot point of like, one of the characters is in North Carolina and her whole dream has always been to get out. And she has to kind of go through this process of understanding it shouldn't have to be a choice between my home and my family or being like an out queer woman in the world. Like I shouldn't have to make that choice. And I think that's the work that like people who are moving here or who are coming back or who are even leaving, but reflecting on these experiences, that is why it's so important, because you could be the person for someone else that could help them understand, oh, you mean I don't have to leave like what feels known and important to me in order to have a life that I can enjoy, right? That's possible for me here. That was mind blowing for me. And I hope we can get to a point where stuff like that is not mind blowing, because it shouldn't have to be.
Absolutely. I think that sort of like normalization and also of the intersectionality, like we talked about and that you're talking about here, is like, I feel like people feel like they need to compartmentalize and they need to do things in silos and isolation. Like if I'm from the South, I can't be from here. Or if I identify this way, I can't be that way. And so really going back to one of our original questions, the importance of that exposure to intersectionality, conversation around it, modeling for it, using our voices so that we can stand up for somebody else that may not have been that far on their journey or haven't been exposed to it yet. So this is like a shifting gears question, because I feel like our conversation has been very like optimistic and hopeful, and I'm so excited about the work that you're doing. And then we know that in parts of our country, in different states right now, there's a lot of talk of banning books and anti-truth legislation and just the dangerous exclusion of diverse voices. And this is butting heads and coming up at a time where our conversation right here of how important it is to have diverse representation. So what do you think about all of this? Like what's currently being debated and how do you cope with that being an author and being, you know, the person that you're being in the world and facing this landscape?
Oh yeah. It's I could go on and on about that. It's so hard. And I think one thing that's really hard is you're watching a school environment that the students are very diverse and the staff is not. I think my school, both the schools I've taught in, you know, the teaching body is largely white women. And that well-intentioned, it's not that there's anything wrong with going into teaching as a white woman, but there are problems that trickle down because you're not going to be able to relate to a lot of experiences your students are having. I've been in classrooms where we won't talk about the January 6th riots. We didn't talk about them when they happened last year. I've had classes where I've had students, you know, I give them a piece of paper to draw on for fun, and they're telling me, I'm drawing the rebel flag. And I say, well, what's that? And I look down and it's the Confederate flag on the piece of paper. And then we have to have conversations about what that means and what that is, because they're not getting that education. I've been in classrooms where the Civil War has been taught as the War of Northern Aggression. And I think this is where critical empathy work has become so important to me, because I cannot judge an 11-year-old for repeating what they're hearing at home, right? It's a larger problem. And I think, again, it goes back to like storytelling and exposure. I think so much of it of, you know, they might hear that from their parents, and their parents might hear that from their parents or their friends, and this stuff trickles down over and over generationally. And unless we start exposing people to, you know, someone might meet someone and they might get to know them, and then they might realize, oh, that's a queer person, but I don't hate them. We got along fine. Maybe I don't have to hold on to these stereotypes that I've been taught. StoryCorps has an amazing initiative. They were doing it at least when I was working there. I'm not sure if they still do it, but they would sit down for StoryCorps is an organization that people come in and they record conversations, very podcast style. And then they live in the Library of Congress in an archive, and they also broadcast on NPR. But they had an initiative called, and I believe they're still doing it, called the One Small Step Initiative, where they would sit down people from opposing political viewpoints and they would have them have an honest conversation with one another. That to me is kind of what critical empathy work looks like. We cannot live in our bubbles. It has been very difficult to come in as a teacher, and I know I disagree politically with a lot of other people in my schools, right? I know that. I'm sure other people know that. I can't come in as an outsider to this community, though, and try to just push my beliefs on everybody all the time. This is where they're from. And I'm ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm not from here. This is not my community. And there are nuances within that of you have to hold on to an element of like, I believe there is hope and possibility for change. And I also have to really put in this critical empathy practice to try to understand how we got here. And I think right now everyone feels a lot of anger about what's going on in the world, and understandably so. But that anger, we have to do something with it, and we have to try to understand it. If we don't try to do that, I think we're just going to simmer on it and it's all going to explode. And what you see when you work with kids and you go all the way back is they can sit in a classroom and they can get along just fine, even if they're disagreeing on things all the time at home. That's almost beautiful in a way to watch. And I think we can learn a lot from that. It is also terrifying to watch what's happening with censorship and books being banned. I had books that, I mean, I think my school banned Harry Potter when I was growing up in the North Carolina school system. I'm sure if I were to publish my books, people would ban them in schools. I would love to like dedicate my novel to my students. There are also a lot of things about my life that I hide from my students because I'm a visitor in this community and I don't want them to know everything about who I am. But I do think that, like, again, students want to have these conversations, and with internet and social media the way they are these days, if we don't have them with them, they will seek them out and have them themselves. And if we're banning everything from the classroom, they're just going to go home and find it. And we have to see ourselves as adults almost as a guide for that. So I just did a huge unit on spoken word with my students. Right now we're doing mythology. And like one thing I'm trying to do is not just teach them Greek and Roman gods, but really look at like pantheons of gods from all around the world, right? Give them some representation of people from their own culture. That's not always encouraged in schools. I'm sure there've been many angry parent phone calls about the work I do or the things I allow my students to write, but you have to weigh that risk yourself, I think. There's gonna be consequences to every decision we make, but I think there are larger consequences to trying to control everything that's being taught or that's being said, because that's where education is really becoming a system to teach people how to think one specific way. And that does, I think, permeate in a variety of places. We're seeing, you know, very, very liberal cities that are pushing it's the same kind of narrative on the opposite end of the spectrum. And we do have to allow people ultimately to think for themselves and make up their own opinions on things. We can't push one side or the other. And realistically, it shouldn't just be two sides of every issue. There's commonality and overlap and everything, and nothing in the world is a binary. And I hope that literature and storytelling can be a practice that becomes transformative to move past that binary rather than just replicating it on either side, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally does. And as you were talking, I was just thinking about the choices that we have to make in the work that we do and what we do in the world to be inauthentically authentic and authentically inauthentic at times. You know, there's such a mix with those two, you know, what we choose to share and what we choose to hold back. You know, that goes back to like how we come to that in ourselves and cultivate that. And what do we, how do we figure that out and be at peace with that? And it really brings us to the last question. We could talk forever, Spencer. Jen and I are so enjoying this. I know our listeners are, but we talk a lot on Namasteach about self-care. And part of, you know, Jen and I, as authentic leaders and what we do, we practice self-care. And that's one way that you can know who you are and bring your whole self to your work. But we want to ask you what ways that you cultivate self-care and what are the non-negotiables when it comes to caring for yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Self-care is so hard. And it's such a word that is being so commodified these days of like people just pushing products at you for self-care. So one thing for me that's been, I think, really transformative in like my self-care practice, and this is where being back in a rural area has helped me a lot to get away from like advertising and just constant, you know, in New York City, you could walk down the street, you'd see 10 different things for something advertising self-care just in two blocks. Here, if I'm going for a walk in the woods without my phone, I don't have all these distractions. There's a lot of writers. There's this weird commonality of writers who are also runners. I am also a runner and a writer, but it's something of like this element of self-discipline of like to write a book, you've got to have that discipline. To run a marathon, I've never run a marathon, but you have to have that discipline to run a marathon, right? And to a lot of people, I think from an outside eye, these kinds of practices can seem like punitive. I find for me, like going for a 7-mile walk or run is really freeing in a way. I'm someone who I lean heavily into like exercise as a form of self-care, and not exercise as in like, I'm going to join the fancy gym and have a $400 subscription and go to all these classes. Nothing wrong with that. I used to be a 7 days a week hot yoga person until the pandemic hit, but there's something about exercise and movement of your body is completely free at the end of the day. You can walk out barefoot into the woods. You can jump around in your bedroom. You can lace on a pair of shoes and just go. And that doesn't necessarily require any kind of financial like transaction, which I think frees you up to then actually have the transformative experience with self-care, because you're then able to say, well, I'm not buying anything. I'm not supporting anything. It's just me and my thoughts and my body. I think energy is everything. And movement is just a way to get rid of stagnant energy. I would have lost my mind as a creative person if I didn't have things like meditation or exercise. And those are completely free practices. I like to think of like studios or apps maybe as tools in all of those things, but you don't need them for self-care. And some people, you know, they love taking a bubble bath and doing that kind of thing. I think for me, it's learning not to tune out my thoughts or the way I'm feeling, you know, not just to put in headphones and ignore it all, but to really sit with it. And meditation is an incredible practice for that. It's also very difficult. It took me years to learn how to like sit with myself in silence. I could never do it. I would never walk down the street without my headphones. I'd like have a total panic attack if I left my headphones at home. And now I can go and like run 10 miles and not listen to music. And that's probably my biggest form of self-care, but writing as well. And I tell my students this all the time of like, I make them keep a journal. They hate it. They hate me for it. I give them prompts every day at class. We have a box in the room I keep post-it notes, and I have a little thing that says, how are you feeling? And I have them just come in and like write a little post-it note. They get so mad at me. They're 14-year-olds. They're like, I don't want to talk about how I feel. I'm like, well, you have to talk about how you feel. You have to process it somehow. And that is radical and transformative and a form of self-care. or at least my form of self-care.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. We're just loving this and the meditation piece. And Jen and I, we talk about this all the time and with our listeners, and it's so much that you could do for self-care that doesn't cost a dime. And I'm glad you brought that up. Jen, you can wrap it up.
But I don't want to. I'm loving our
conversation. I know.
But yeah, I love the idea. Yeah, I'm just gonna take back real quick. Just being like you, your thoughts and your body, like that's what you need. That whole like accessibility piece of like, you know, we think that we sometimes need the fancy gym membership or all the latest apps. And at the end of the day, it's finding a system that works for you. So a lot of our conversations circle back to that. It's a personalized journey, right? So thanks for just reiterating that. This conversation has been transformative for me, actually, and I really enjoyed it. I love the idea of like storytelling and literature as a transformative practice. I love the idea of like radical empathy and just thinking about representation, thinking about ways that we show up in the world authentically and encourage others to do the same. So many amazing takeaways. And I guess my final question is, where can we find you? Where can our listeners find you, Spencer, if they want to continue this conversation?
Yeah. Absolutely. You can find me a lot of places. But first and foremost, you can find me with Good Folk, which is the newsletter that I run. And it's Good Folk, GOODFOLK, .substack.com. So you can find me there. We're on Twitter and email at Good Folks Only. That is a newsletter that I publish. We aim for twice a week. It doesn't always happen, but we do a couple different components with it. So I do a lot of like unpacking of some of these issues, just like long form essay posts. We do weekly resource roundups where I'll share all kinds of things happening in the South, people who are amazing, things that were published, music you should check out, try to just compiling different resources and contests. We also have people who I interview. If people come in and submit work. So if you have a story about the South, whether you're from the South, you live in the South, you moved to the South, I would love to hear it. You can email it to us. We will publish it. We are trying to pay contributors. So that is an ongoing thing. And we're going to be doing some writing workshops as well, and some things with some local rural artists coming up. So we're getting ready to hit 1 year on that, which is very exciting. And yeah, stay tuned. If you want to come write with me, I'll lead you through a variety of prompts. It'll all be virtual. But yeah, that's Good Folk at goodfolk.substack.com is largely where you can find me. And then anything with girls right now, that'll all be coming out. Our newest anthology will be coming out this spring. So sometime in May, usually May 18th. Otherwise, my email is Spencer G. George, which I'll put in the thing. And please reach out to me about anything, anytime.
Awesome. Thank you. Spencer, thank you so much. This has been an incredible conversation. And we say that when we have these conversations, this is the best one, but I'm saying this is like the best one. I mean, they're all wonderful. And you just brought a wealth of knowledge and what you do in the world and your writing and as an artist and just a change agent. I mean, the things that you're talking about and bringing these voices and the narratives and the stories, and this is how we can heal as a country, as a world. And it's so important. So I just thank you so much. I'm so full right now, just having this conversation and knowing you and knowing your mom. And it's just beautiful. So I'm very grateful. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Y'all are both amazing. And I'm honored to be here.
Really? First of many conversations.
Yeah.
All right. Everybody stay well, stay healthy, move your body, and just do all the things that fill you up.
Yes. Next time we'll see y'all from Namas Teach. This is Tisha.
This is Jen.
And we'll see y'all next time. Thank you.